Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Shackman. Today we're exploring a unique moment in journalistic history with my guest, Tricia Romano. Tricia has written the definitive oral history of The Village Voice, a publication that not only captured but also shaped the zeitgeist of New York City from the paper's inception in 1955 until its closure in 2018. But The Voice was more than a newspaper. It was a cultural beacon, a meeting point of news, culture, lifestyle, embodying the ever-changing spirit of New York. It's one of those rare instances where a city and a publication converge to capture something unique at a particular moment, akin to Playboy in Chicago in the 50s, Rolling Stone in San Francisco in the 60s, and Texas Monthly defining the so-called New South in the 70s. Tricia Romano's work, The Freaks Come Out to Write, weaves together the voices of over 200 contributors, offering a panoramic view of a publication that was as much a part of New York's identity as the skyline itself. From its idealistic beginnings to its tawdry decline, The Village Voice was a beacon for the counterculture, a platform for groundbreaking journalism, and a battleground for internal squabbles and rivalries. The Village Voice chronicled the transformations of New York from the gritty pre-gentrification era to the polished streets of its current consumer-driven landscape. It was a publication where literary giants like Norman Mailer laid the groundwork and writers like Colson Whitehead honed their craft. It took the AIDS crisis seriously in its early days when others turned away, and it called out Donald Trump as a corrupt con man long before he entered the political arena. More than just an institution of New York, The Village Voice set the stage for what would happen to journalism. It was both a symbol of its golden age and a harbinger of its decline today. Tricia Romano spent 8 years at The Village Voice. As a contributing writer, she wrote features and award-winning cover stories about culture and music. She's been a staff writer at the Seattle Times and served as an editor-in-chief of The Stranger, Seattle's alternative news weekly. Her work has been published in numerous publications, and it is my pleasure to welcome Tricia Romano here to talk about The Freaks Came Out to Write, the definitive history of The Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Tricia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, it is a delight to have you here. It is impossible to think about The Village Voice without looking at New York at the same time. The degree to which they are so deeply intertwined is one of the really powerful concepts I think one comes away with. Talk about that first.
Well, The Voice is the ultimate local newspaper. It's the local newspaper that is the most, was the most embedded with the city that I can remember in recent memory. I mean, it doesn't exist without, it isn't alive, and it doesn't have its full powers unless New York is also at its full power. And when New York was the center of the universe and media and culture and politics was when The Voice was ascendant. And so you can't have one without the other.
It also then becomes subject to the whims and the changes in New York, and that the publication mm-hmm. would change as the city changed. And the city actually changed in some ways in reaction to The Voice. Talk about that.
The Voice is the mirror of the city. So see gentrification taking over the city, and that affects The Voice. That affects the kind of people that can afford to live in the city, the kind of people that are reading the paper and what they want to see and what the coverage is. You know, something like the Tompkins Square police riots in 1988 was a tentpole event when gentrification was really starting to take over the East Village, which had been just like a squatter's paradise. And The Voice was there to cover all of that. And in the end, when media becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and The Voice becomes sold over and over again to bigger and bigger owners, it gets further and further away from what it was founded to be.
One of the other things that it led the way on in so many respects is the whole notion of personal journalism, sort of the personal brand as journalism, which we see so much of today, really had its roots there at The Voice.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we forget is that the first person didn't appear in newspapers in the 50s. just was not done. There wasn't an op-ed page in the New York Times at that time. Like, there was the editorial page, but there wasn't like a full op-ed section that we see now. That didn't come, I think, until the 70s. And so first person writing was not something you saw in newspapers and magazines, unless it was maybe in the women's magazines or something. But The Voice just sort of let everybody be who they were. And they allowed all the feminist writers from the second wave feminist movement who were writing for The Voice to use first person. And one of them was Vivian Gornick, and she wrote one of her amazing essays in The Voice that was really considered one of the hallmarks of feminist journalism at that time. We sort of predated, I think, what was new journalism. We were new journalism, but it was different than the Tom Wolfe style.
How much of that was intentional and how much of it was accidental as The Voice evolved?
I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I think it was just accidental. I think it was just open. They called it the open newspaper. And Dan Wolfe and Ed Banter, the two founders who were around the longest, they had a forum. And in the beginning, it was like they had copy. They needed copy. They didn't have enough copy to fill the pages, right? And so it became, they were always looking, scrounging for writers and for stories. But it became more established. I think once it became established in the 60s, it was established as a place where you could be more free in the way that you wrote and what you wrote about. And so it attracted those kinds of writers.
One of the other things about it, and another way that it seemed to be so much ahead of its time, is it was what you would call today, I suppose, a lifestyle publication. That it, not unlike the New York Times has evolved to today, that it was both news and culture. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you just said, it was presenting an alternative way of living your life, one that didn't involve like living in the suburbs and being married and having kids and a picket fence and a two-car garage and all the things that you're supposed to have in the 50s and 60s. And it was very urban, and it was very much about people who consumed culture and politics and were intellectuals, and that's kind of how they centered their life and the way of living. And it just, because of the personal aspect of it, you could actually read people who lived like this and who thought like this and get to know how they lived.
And eventually the cultural aspect of it would really overtake the news aspect of it, or so it seemed.
Well, I mean, you could argue that it was already like that from the beginning, because in the beginning, they didn't really have real news reporters. They had Mary Pirro Nichols, who was a housewife who became a reporter through her advocacy to stop Robert Moses from building anything through Washington Square Park in that area of the village. And then in that way, they became newsy, and they were also advocating to get rid of Carmine DiSapio in favor of Ed Koch. But vast majority of the paper was theater ads in the beginning, at film criticism. And by the 60s, I would say you had the music section starting to bubble up. And in the 70s, the music section was really big. And, you know, by the time the 70s rolls around, you have Andrew Sayers. So I would argue, actually, that culture has always been the bedrock of the paper. It's just that in our society, we really value hard news and investigative news and takedowns of politicians more than we value cultural criticism and just art in general. And part of that is the sort of patriarchal overlay of news in general. Like, I think even now, most of newsrooms are like 70% male. And it was even worse back then. So, and the way journalism was set up in the 50s, 60s, 70s is that news dominated the front page, hard news, investigations, even though most of your readers were picking it up to read Jules Feiffer or see what was going on in Off-Broadway that weekend, or later trying to see what the listings were for independent movies. Most of the time, front of the book dominated the cover because of sort of industry standards.
One of the things that you quote somebody, I think it was maybe Richard Goldstein, one of the early editors, that there was this tendency not to hire experts per se, but people who were actually doing things, living through what was going on. What was the talk about what that was about?
The notion is the New York Times or other newspapers, they were very much about objectivity and journalism. So you were covering something from the outside, which has some benefits, but often, especially with culture, they get it wrong. And so the advantage of having somebody who is part of the scene writing about the scene means they really, really are inside it in that world, and they know what is happening way before anyone else does. And Richard was, he tells a story in the book about he got Lou Reed to play his wedding because the Velvet Underground played his wedding because he had helped Lou Reed's girlfriend with a medical procedure. And he also would be at parties and talking to Andy Warhol and all of that. And like, you can't replicate that if you are some deaf mainstream newspaper reporter. You'll never even know where those parties are to even get close to Andy Warhol. So that is one of the things that The Voice really had an advantage of over other places way, way, way earlier in the game.
And because of the personal approach that we talked about before, and the people that started it and the people that were attracted and wound up working there, talk a little bit about who some of those people were. Because they're names that it would go on to become almost household names in the journalism world.
Well, I mean, I think you've got somebody like Richard, certainly. He wrote Popism. He's credited as being one of the first rock journalists. And, you know, other people that came in later were like Greg T. and Nelson George, who covered a lot of hip-hop and R&B in the early 80s and mid-80s. You know, Jonas Mekas, who was the first film critic for the paper, he, you know, just walked in and said, you know, why don't you have anything on cinema? And they said, well, I don't know. Why don't you do it? And so he started writing his column, and a movie, I think it was Movie Journal. I think it's Movie Journals. And he, you know, he was an underground avant-garde filmmaker himself. He had a loft that showed all of these films that he made and his friends made. He had screenings, and he was writing about this stuff every single week. And you could not find any of these films being mentioned anywhere in the rest of media, but you could read about it in The Voice on a weekly basis. And so, you know, he's a classic example of, he's not a journalist. He's not a trained writer. He was a Lithuanian refugee, and he had a huge platform for, I think it was like almost 20 years at The Voice.
And of course, film continued to be a big deal with people like Andrew Saris and Jay Hoberman.
Yeah, and we, you know, they also had Amy Taubin and Manola Dargis, who's the big New York Times critic now. She had her start at The Voice. And it's been a great place, a breeding ground for amazing critics in general across the board. Robert Christgau and Ann Powers in the music section, Gary Giddens. He was like an early jazz critic there. We also had a massive crew of amazing critics in theater. Michael Feingold, who just passed away, he just dominated the theater section for 20, 30 years. But there were so many that came in and out of that section. Like Charles McNulty is at the LA Times now, writing theaters. So it was really a place that gave criticism equal stature as reported features or news investigations.
So many people that came out of there. I mean, you've mentioned a few of it. Also Stanley Crouch and Grail Marcus and Jim Walcott.
Oh, James Walcott's just amazing. I mean, he might be one of the best ever to do it, right? Everybody, I mean, he was writing about, like, another example of being part of the thing that you're writing about. He wandered over to CBGB's every night and saw, like, all those amazing bands that were coming out in the 70s, you know, Talking Heads and Ramones and Patti Smith, and he was just writing them up, and it was in his backyard. And by that time, The Voice had a national profile. Like, people around the country knew about it and knew that it was something that they wanted to read if they wanted to get a sense of what was going on and culture before Rolling Stone or any of the other magazines at that time. And I think that just the idea of somebody writing about what's in their backyard having a national impact, you know, that was maybe newer at that time. We didn't have blogs. We had TikTok. Like now you can TikTok something and it reaches the entire world.
But there were columns from people like Nat Hentoff and Jack Newfield.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about the influence that they had.
Nat Hentoff started off as a jazz writer, and he said he wanted to write for The Voice, but he didn't want to write about jazz because he was kind of tired of it. And he's quite famous at that point, even in the 50s, as a jazz writer, a critic. And so they said, sure. And, you know, they weren't paying anybody anything for the most part. If they were paying anything, it was very little. And so he decided to write about civil liberties, and that was a big passion of his. And so he became an authority on civil liberties by the 60s, and still many of his columns and his ideas are sort of the leading, I don't know how you say it, but he was very influential in that area, and a lot of people still cite him. And then Jack Newfield, he started the Landlords, Best Landlord, The Worst Landlords, and The Worst Judges. And that was a first, and there was even a case that went up to the Supreme Court based on one of his, on his best judge or worst judges story. And basically saying that the opinion of the writer is protected under as speech. And these are the worst judges. These are the worst landlords. And before that, judges were untouchable. And then later he also wrote about lead poisoning, and that helped get the laws in New York changed to make it so that lead was not used, lead paint, which seems amazing when you think about it now. But just one person can have such a big impact.
One of the things that emerges from all of this, at least as it comes across in your book, is that there were so many strong personalities, so much talent, that some of which we've talked about, that it also became kind of a viper's nest of personalities.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone believed in their issue as the issue with the that was the most important. And they also had huge egos and not afraid to speak their minds. And that's a pretty volatile combination. By the time I got there, it wasn't quite so antagonistic. I mean, it's often and become not really corporate, but not quite as crazy as it sounded in the 70s. It was a much smaller staff too, in a single room or in a more confined space, like where everybody could like see each other and hear each other and had to walk past each other. And so that just brings all those frictions to the fore.
And that plus that there was this culture that evolved really from the very beginning of these strong personalities from Mailer at the start.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because he has like an impact and then he doesn't. Like his involvement and his name definitely helped to draw a certain kind of person to the paper and in both readership and writing. But he was only there for a few months, I believe. And he threw a tantrum because they messed up a word in his very late, overly long copy. And that was pretty typical that somebody would throw a tantrum and walk out. Many writers over the years did that. And the thing about having an unconventional staff in an unconventional workplace is that you're going to have unconventional behavior, some of which may not be so good.
But it really became inculcated in the culture of the place, it seems.
Yeah, for a while, I think. You had Stanley Crouch, who got in a big fight with Harry Allen later, and over hip-hop, but not really. It was really about something bigger than that, about whether or not hip-hop was good for Black people. It was a good way to represent themselves. And Stanley was much more conservative and really was appalled by hip-hop. And he had a Harry Allen, who was the writer at the time that really covered hip hop, and he was even on Public Enemy's record. Don't Believe the Hype. It's just that after that, though, Stanley was fired, and I think that became maybe a turning point for physical altercations. But they still rabble roused in front and whatnot, and I'm sure there were still shouting matches in the newsroom. But you know, that was, I think, a turning point where we can't really do this. Not really okay.
Talk about the succession of owners, because it really reflects, I mean, the changes in journalism over this period of time. The owner after owner after owner.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things like when I went to the reunion party in 2017 and saw Ed Banter, who was one of the living co-founders, and he was then 95. This guy was a psychologist. He had no desire. Like the reason for them starting this wasn't to become rich. They were living pretty poorly for a really long time. And then the first bit of money they got was in the 70s when they sold it to Carter Burton, who was a dilettante. And he was a city councilman in New York for a while. And he was married. I can't remember who.
Amanda, right?
Amanda Burr. Yeah. She's a man about town. So he's like not too far from the origin, but he's already much fancier than they ever were. And every time it gets sold, it's becoming so successful that it's making enough money that it's starting to attract people who want power. And that never seemed to be the impetus behind starting The Voice. Like, that was not Dan Wolf's motivation. From anything that I can tell, was power. He liked listening to writers and helping, you know, writers grow, and he liked stories, and he liked literature, intellectual ideas. And when you get to Clay Felker, this man was he's the founder of New York Magazine, brilliant editor, but he really wanted power and money. That was his lifeblood. And then, of course, he fails, and Rupert Murdoch takes over. And I mean, do I even have to say like what Rupert Murdoch wants? And so every time it's sold to someone who's richer and who's more interested in money and power. And The Village Voice was not about money or power. It was anti-money and power, if anything. So it just kind of gets further and further away from the core. And in 2000s, when it becomes bought by a group of bankers, the apex of it, right? Like, now it's like an investment firm. It's not even one person that owns it. It's like a group of banking entities. And that's as far from the Village Voice's like origin story as you can get.
Talk about the way the publication changed with each successive ownership, how it really affected the publication.
Well, I think for the most part, it wasn't as changed as you would think, but it just became more professionalized in the sense that like it wasn't as rowdy and free for all. Like, it became more like a hierarchical structure inside of edit, which is normal when you expand section editors and sub editors and all of that, a little more formalized. But I would say up until the 2000s, around when they were about to sell the paper to the bankers, it was still allowed to do what it wanted what it had always done. Some of the editors may have changed some of that, like Don Forst in the 2000s, who was there when I was there. He was a very odd pairing with The Voice because he was from Newsday and mainstream newspaper. He was very old-fashioned in the way he approached news. He was the antithesis of The Voice. And here he is running it. And he was very much like, no first person. Have a nut graph. These are not things that we had ever done. And of course, people got away with breaking those rules all the time. But if he had any interest in your story, he would be paying attention to how it's written and he would mark it up. But by the 2000s, they were starting to force the music and, you know, all the back of the book sections into sort of templates. So the lead review was 800 words, the sidebar was 250, and then there was like a little, you know what I mean? It was just like two or three elements to a page, and each story was capped at a certain length, and that had never happened. And that was kind of right around the time when the internet started showing up, and people were like talking about how people don't have the attention span anymore. They only want to read 1,000 words. So it was a combination of factors, I would say.
And we can't finish any conversation about The Voice without talking about the classifieds, which were a key part of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. People don't really understand. I think this generation now doesn't understand that that's how you found your life, was through the classifieds of a newspaper, and The Voice especially. The apartment ads were very sought after because New York City's apartment market is so competitive, and apartments are so expensive, and there's so few of them. You know, people would stand online and Tuesday nights to get the first copy so that they could like start making calls to landlords. I mean, the idea of like, you know, the romance ads, those were dating ads. Like that was something that was happening in print way before we had Match or OkCupid or any of that. You know, and then when Craigslist shows up and the internet shows up and those things are being offered for free or very cheap and there's no middleman to put them up online, that becomes a big hit to The Voice's income and to pretty much all alternative newsweeklies. Because by the 2000s, all of them are free. And if you don't have a subscription based model, you're not getting any other revenue except for advertising. And if your advertising is cut in half because your competitor that doesn't have an overhead at all is just giving stuff away for free, it's really, really harmful to your business. And so that's why we don't see very many alt weeklies anymore, because they just don't have a model to sustain it.
And finally, Tricia, talk a little bit about how it all came to an end and what you look back at primarily after this whole project and talking to all these people. What is the legacy of The Voice?
Well, it's still kind of trekking along in this very odd way. The latest person to buy it is a cannabis entrepreneur, and he owns several smaller neighborhood newspapers, and he also just bought Paper Magazine. He also owns LA Weekly, and they're alive in a very modest way, and they are, but they don't have the impact that they used to. And part of that is just, I think you have to really build a bigger staff, and you have to penetrate social media, neither of which is doing. But the legacy of The Voice is really all around us. I mean, every time we open up any kind of website and read an article in the first person or an opinionated news piece or a piece of long form criticism, like that's all Village Voice legacy. And I don't think that we would see this kind of proliferation of writing, this kind of writing, without The Voice showing everyone how to do it.
Tricia Romano, her book is The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Tricia, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.